This is Michael Schultz, director of Car Wash Cooley High, Grease Lightning, Which Way Is Up, Sergeant Pepper's On and On, The Last Dragon, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio.
Everybody to Film Wax Radio episode number 317. Well, welcome everybody, and thanks for tuning into the show, and thanks for downloading the show or streaming it, however you are doing it. It's really a pleasure to be back here. It's an incredible episode. If you're a movie person or if you're interested in what's going on in Brooklyn, you know, we have a real jam-packed show going on here. Well, just to do a quick table of contents, if you will, for today, we have first Daniel Derning. He is the founder of the Red Hook Film Festival, and what's great is he's a local. He's been living in New York City, I think, his entire life, so he's a real New Yorker, and he's an artist, and he's really managed to make the Red Hook Film Festival into something. It's coming up, actually, this weekend. On Saturday and Sunday, the 17th and 18th this weekend. So we'll have on Daniel Derning, who is the founder of the Red Hook Film Festival. I think they're in their ninth season, and I'm hoping that next year, when I have a little bit more time, I'll manage to be a little bit involved in the festival. So maybe that'll happen next year. So it's great to bring on somebody from Brooklyn, or he does live in Brooklyn, and the festival, of course, takes place in Brooklyn, so it's nice to get back to my roots and to bring on someone from the neighborhood. And so Daniel will be coming on, and we talk a lot about Brooklyn and about New York City also. The conversation goes off the rails, if you will. After that, we have filmmaker Stephen Winter returns to the podcast. Now, Stephen made a fictional version of this movie called The Portrait of Jason, which was a documentary, a Verite documentary directed by Shirley Clark way back when in the 60s. So Stephen shot a fictional reimagining of that day when Shirley Clark shot her documentary about this guy named Jason Holliday. And in Stephen's version, the fictional version, Jason is played by the artist and filmmaker Jack Waters. And his performance is outstanding. I saw the film at BAM Cinema Fest this past summer. Actually, I saw it before that. I saw it at my friend Jonathan Couette, who's a filmmaker, his apartment in a private rough cut screening. And then I saw it again at BAM Cinema Fest. And I went and I finally got to see the original source, which is the documentary Portrait of Jason. I saw that. And then I went to BAM Cinema Fest and I saw the film again. And it was just a delight. This film is... We're going to talk about it in great detail, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but it is really an artistic, visionary work, I must say. And one of my favorite movies of the year, certainly at the top of my favorite narrative films. And I guess those at MoMA agreed, because the film is going to have an unprecedented 10-day run at MoMA beginning Monday, the 19th of October, and running right through, I think, the following Tuesday, the 27th. I might have my dates slightly wrong there, but if you go to the MoMA website, or if you seek out information about the Jason and Shirley, which is the name of the film, you can find out more. It really is worth your time. If you're in the New York area during this period of time, please do strongly consider going to a screening of the film. It'll be playing 10 days straight. And I understand that Stephen and Jack and the actress or artist and actress who plays Shirley Clark, her name is Sarah Schulman, she'll be there, and Jack and Stephen, all of them, and there will be a bunch of screenings that they'll all appear at. In fact, somebody will be probably at every screening, at least, if not all of them, so go and do that. And on this particular segment today, the second segment, we have Jack and Stephen, and unfortunately no Sarah this time, but one day hopefully we'll rectify that. So that's what's going to be coming up. And then to top it off, if that wasn't enough, and it certainly could be, finally I will be posting the segment with Michael Schultz, who is the director of Car Wash, and what else? He did Grease Lightning and Which Way Is Up and a number of many other films and a lot of TV in recent years. And Michael was feted at the Museum of the Moving Image over the last few weeks. It just recently ended. And I got a chance to talk to Michael, and it was, I believe me, the guy is just stellar, a stellar guest. I could have talked to him for hours, and I hope to have more conversations with him. And I would have, but I had the Woodstock Film Festival, the Hamptons Film Festival, and, of course, the New York Film Festival, all going on in the last couple of weeks, and just was overwhelmed a bit. But I saw some incredible, spectacular films in the last few weeks, one of which I want to mention right now, which, well, there's a couple. But one is the Michael Moore film, which is called Where to Invade Next. It's a really special film, and I would say that I was not expecting, you know, you kind of figure Michael Moore said everything he has to say, and, you know, he's a very divisive guy. A lot of people just are immediately have in mind that this guy does this and I'm not into it, and or, you know, he's lacks any subtlety and all. But I will say this is his best work in a long time, maybe since Fahrenheit 9/11. And I'd say that this is his angriest work because I laughed all the way through it, as did the audience in East Hampton that I saw it with. And I'm so glad I went. And then the next day I went to see him do a conversation with Marshall Fine, who, somebody who I've been interested in and bringing on the show too. And that was a great conversation. That was in Sag Harbor as part of the festival. And so I got to really hear Michael Moore talk quite a bit between the Q&A at the screening and then the next day in the conversation that he had. So I'm behind this film. Also, I want to mention the producers of this film are Carl Deal and Tia Lesson, who are longtime friends of Film Wax Radio. And I've done some of the Brick TV stuff with them. I'm just huge fans of their films. They did, of course, Trouble the Water about 5-6 years ago, and they did Citizen Coke last year. And I just think they're the sumo super talented filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, certainly. So just know that they're producing Michael Moore makes me kind of excited. Maybe we can get Michael Moore on this time. What do you think? Put the good vibe out there. Put the good word out. If you know a way to make that happen, please do. I know I'm working on it, and maybe we'll get a little bit of a shot this time with Michael Moore. In the meantime, let's see. I'll talk a little bit more maybe about a couple of other films I saw, but let's get into the show. Again, the first segment here is with Daniel Durning, who is the founder of the Red Hook Film Festival. Again, it's going on this weekend, the 17th and 18th, down in Red Hook. You can check it out. Go to their website, redhookfilmfest.com, and find out everything you need to know about this year's festival. My conversation now with Daniel Durning. Daniel Durning, did you found the Red Hook Film Festival?
I feel like I did find the Red Hook Film Festival. Yes, I'm the founder. It found me. Yes, I'm the founder of the Red Hook Film Festival. I've mm-hmm. been doing it for going on 9 years. Mm-hmm. And initially I was chairing a show at the Brooklyn Waterfront Artist Coalition.
Right.
And this local favorite movie, Mike Olshan, put together a screening room, mm-hmm. and within the BWAC premises, and said, "Okay, this is a screening room." I mm-hmm. said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I don't know." You know, he's going to show. He screens old movies. Mm-hmm. He's got a collection of old movies, okay. And he shows them all around Brooklyn.
What's his name?
Mike Olshan.
Olshan, okay.
Otherwise known as Movie Mike.
Oh, Movie Mike.
Movie
oh, very good.
Mike.
Right.
And so I'm very much like, okay, kids, well, let's put on a show. Let's mm-hmm. How about doing a film festival? So BWAC said, go right ahead. Mm-hmm. So I started that about 9 years ago, and I had done other events like that, and it kind of started. And I started working with different programmers and showing small artsy films and kind of growing it.
And it seems like a commitment to local filmmakers.
Well, it is a commitment. It's every year I kick myself in the butt going, I don't believe I've done it again.
Well, where, I mean, you know, I'm more, I mean, you know, loyalty-wise.
Oh, of course. The loyalty of kind of to the arts.
Yeah. But specifically, I mean, when I've gone, I think I was there twice.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I you know, it could have also been that My Brooklyn was showing right after Heather's film.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah. So it was just one of those things where I guess I was there. And Nick was involved, I think, in that.
Nick Shimkin. Yeah, Nick Shimkin.
Yeah.
From the Brooklyn...
The Arts Council?
The Brooklyn Arts Council.
At the time? Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. He's been living in New Orleans for the last couple of years, so.
And is he doing any film festivals?
I don't know what he's... I think he must be. I'm guessing he has to be involved some way. I don't see it.
Because initially he was going to go to, like, North Carolina, and he was going down south to further his career.
Uh-huh.
And
well, he ended up even further south.
Well, New Orleans is a little bit more fun than some of the other places he was talking about.
So. Yeah, yeah. No, it's rich with history and art and culture and much and food and...
Everything.
Yeah. But getting back to the Red Hook Film Festival, so are you... First of all, do you live in Red Hook or do you live nearby? Or?
No, I live in Fort Greene.
Oh, okay.
So it's just literally bike ride over there.
Right.
And... I almost lived in Red Hook, but chose to live other places at the time when I was in art school. And Red Hook is such a phenomenal place. It is, you know...
Unique in a sense.
Unique architecture.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
I love the post-industrial wasteland. Mm-hmm. I love discovering places. I love kind of urban architecture from another era. I think it was some past life thing, but...
Right.
The waterfront has such amazing, I think, architecture, and I'm an artist, I'm a sculptor, I'm a digital artist, I'm an educator and a number of other hats that I wear.
Of course.
Festival director and board of directors of computer graphics and animation. And
like coalitions or whatever?
Yeah,
or like
associations. CGRAPHS, special interest group graphics, okay. Otherwise known as the International Conference of Computer Graphics, and the board of directors of New York City chapters of it. And I've been involved in film for a long time, but I really love kind of old places.
Yeah.
Within the new places. I mean, so Wall Street specifically.
Oh, sure.
Got amazing architecture.
Right.
And Red Hook has got some amazing architecture. But a friend of mine was showing her work at BWAC. You know, she moved to Brooklyn probably 15 years ago. And I was really inspired by BWAC.
Mm-hmm.
The Brooklyn Waterfront Artists Coalition is a very open organization that will almost show anybody's artwork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you participate in the whole event. So you have to volunteer. So it's a volunteer organization. And it's in a, like, 1840s warehouse at the end of the water, at the end of the peninsula, right on the waterfront. And I got involved doing some art there. I put some pieces of work in the show. And they asked me if I would chair one of the shows, and I'm very volunteer-oriented, and said, sure. And kind of like once I moved, I was living in Chelsea, and once I thought I had to live in Brooklyn. But once I lived in Brooklyn, I joined the organization, and I've participated a lot more since then. And, you know, a couple of years into it, Movie Mike put together this little screening room, and the rest is Red Hook Film Festival history.
Back at Superstorm Sandy, what was the last iteration that we call it now?
Hurricane
Sandy. What was the aftermath of that for the warehouse and the immediate neighborhood?
You know, Red Hook Film Festival went off in you know, the second week in October. And the hurricane hit the third week of October. And BWAC was nearly devastated. I mean, in terms of the building, there was about 8 feet of water on the ground floor. It's always
think about that
somewhat.
If you're listening. Think about what I mean. You know, you kind of think, 8 feet, and then you move on to your next thought. But then go back to the thought and think of really what 8 feet of water looks like when you're maybe 5 feet, 8 inches tall.
It's enough to drown you. I mean, we could drown in a bucket, but it's absolutely devastating to anything that you have stored on the first floor. Luckily, BWAC had a couple of floors and a lot of volunteers, so when it started to be known that there's a hurricane heading, we moved a lot of art upstairs. And they're lucky enough to have an upstairs.
Yeah, right.
So you're talking hundreds of pieces of art, a lot of, like, all of their equipment.
Yeah.
But every wall basically got saturated. The screening room that we showed in was underwater by 8 feet. It was devastating to the neighborhood, and it was horrific. I mean, you know, it's downtown Manhattan was blacked out for, you know, about a week. Red Hook was basically blacked out for months. I mean, it was what people don't seem to understand is the people go through the heart of it. Really get devastated.
Well, you know, it has the fortune and this double-edged sword misfortune of the fact that since there is no subway stop within half a mile of where you're talking about anyway, it becomes a lower priority because the services aren't there. So, you know, it's less of a priority all of a sudden to that neighborhood, whereas the neighborhoods that are a bigger priority are those that have more services in there. And I'm sure there's the economics that there's a big group of projects in the center of Red Hook, and I'm sure that had something to do with the priority too. It's just always the case. If you go to the New York subway system, the last trains that usually get replaced are the ones that go through the poor neighborhoods.
Oh, well,
I mean, it's the same side that trickles down.
Yeah, is because it lacks services, therefore the real estate values were down.
Mm-hmm.
It has been basically a forgotten neighborhood of New York, and there are many of them. And it's very poor. I mean, it's basically got projects and two-story buildings throughout the peninsula, and that's it.
When I lived next door during the 80s and into the 90s, I lived in Carroll Gardens.
Yeah.
And even that neighborhood was just an Italian American neighborhood,
yeah,
where a lot of fairly insulated and like a bit of an enclave, where most of the people that lived there didn't go beyond their neighborhood borders. But it's interesting how
Moonstruck was,
yes,
basically that was
right, and that's exactly when I moved into the neighborhood. It was like just when that movie came out. So I would wander around to the Camerari Brothers Bakery. I would wander up the street and all the locations, you know, taking long walks in summer evenings because it was just so beautiful over there. But you did not cross over to the other side of the BQE over there. You did not cross over into Red Hook because if you were white and Nebuchadnezzar like me, you were afraid for your life. And I even had a car for a while, and I remember getting stuck because my post office was right on Court Street on the, you know, on the Red Hooks, you know, and my car stalled and died. And I was terrified. It was another day.
Yeah.
I was terrified. I thought, this is it. I'm going to get killed by these people. And of course, you know, it was a very different time in New York then.
Well, it was Red Hook for the longest time was longshoremen and probably one of the most notorious Puerto Rican biker gangs anywhere in the city. It was a deadly place. I mean, it's a place where the mafia would throw you and give you cement overshoes.
Shoes. Yeah, yeah.
And they'd throw you in the
Gowanus.
The water, and that would be it.
Yeah. Well, don't be afraid if you're considering a trip to New York. It's like most neighborhoods. It's gentrified quite a bit. And in fact, you know,
probably
the reason why
get mugged there. I mean,
No.
It's a lovely place. It's a lot of families.
It's wonderful.
They tore down a lot of buildings. There's no biker gangs anymore.
It's more or less known for most New Yorkers as the place where you go to IKEA.
Fairway's
over there. IKEA's over there.
Yeah.
My kid's pool, where I take him. We love going over there. But I will say the reason why it is such an anomaly, not just because of the bones of it are so great, but also the proximity. It's just among all these other great neighborhoods. So therefore, we don't look at it like, well, we could say this about Canarsie, or we could say this about Gravesend or other neighborhoods, but we don't think of them like, well, since they're not right there by Brooklyn Heights and by Cobble Hill and these other neighborhoods, we don't like look at them the same way, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, like Greg O'Connell is the primary developer of Red Hook. And he won a contract where he basically got the whole waterfront, at least the Van Brunt Street piers, I think, for $1. And started to develop it. And Greg was a New York City policeman. And, you know, he worked really hard. He was out there every day in his pickup truck managing his workers who literally cleaned out every brick and rat nest of the whole waterfront and built it up slowly and surely and was able to get Fairway to come in, was able to, it was very instrumental of getting IKEA to come in and all those docks. He didn't tear down the docks and build high rises. He maintained the artist feel of it. Like, I used to live in Dumbo, and when I first was venturing out into Brooklyn in the 80s, I didn't want to live in Red Hook because there was no egress. I couldn't get out. You could get in, but something goes wrong, and that was it. So I ended up living in Dumbo, and that was also one of those little...
very shady.
Neighborhoods where it was very easy to get killed. Right. And then they were doing that to artists, and you know, it was very dangerous. But, you know, artists have always lived this kind of urban pioneering existence. I mean, I lived in the heroin distribution capital of New York in the Lower East Side. I've lived in Dumbo and Soho when there wasn't a person there, and Tribeca, you know.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bronx, in Highbridge. I'm fifth generation, 100% Irish New York City. So there's a little bit of lore that goes with that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know about the city. I know about the people. I know the politicians. I know the police and firemen.
To give you an image, Daniel looks like he could play an officer.
Well,
there's
a bit of a
mix.
It was very convenient when I lived in the barrio because they would always accuse me of being a cop.
Yeah. You have the character actor cop.
Yeah, I'm 6 feet. I'm over six feet, and if I wore brown shoes, they would know I was a policeman. But, you know, it was fine. And, you know, I'm lucky because I, you know, am big enough to take care of myself and agile enough to get away. So
that's good to know.
You know.
The festival, again, it is now, and it's going into its ninth season?
Ninth year.
Yeah. And I know I'm going to be helping out, like, if not this season, the next one for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was just a little close.
Well, but we put this festival on with a hope and a prayer.
Yeah, I understand.
And, you know, we've done things like recruited filmmakers in the past and really scouring, you know,
Are you in touch with, like, the Brooklyn Filmmaker Collective and like, those guys?
Yeah, I reach out to everyone.
You do,
And I ask everyone. And films were a little bit more scarce in the past.
Right.
And content, like, if an artist made a film, it was an art film. They weren't trying to make a commercial venture. You know, filmmakers make movies. And artists make art. And sometimes they didn't. They look totally different.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of like experimental, or story based, narrative, or
documentary,
kind of freeform.
Or freeform. So the film festival runs on the 17th or 18th, nice and compact, at the warehouse. And we'll put down all the details.
Yeah.
For everybody listening. So if you're living in the New York area, come check it out that weekend if you're in town, because it's a nice place to really talk to filmmakers, to talk to other film lovers and locals. You know, it's very down to earth. It's very grassroots kind of.
Well, it is in a lot of ways, but it also is. You know, the Brooklyn Waterfront Artists Coalition is nice enough to kind of sponsor us our space, and we are in a very large theater in the back of this old warehouse, and we're upstairs.
Okay, so you
now, so we have four times the room of that smaller theater that Mike built, or I actually built it for Mike. And,
which is good if you're filling it.
Oh, and we're filling it.
That's
the important
part.
We have a bar. We have food.
Oh,
we have couches.
Couches,
and
Wi-Fi
seating. Wonderful seating and miles and miles of couches.
I'll have to come.
And
I'll have to come by.
But we have an art show. I mean, the Brooklyn Waterfront is holding its affordable art show this month. It's open. It's today. And you can experience art. You can experience film. You can have a day out in Red Hook. You can go to Fairway when you get out. You know, they're not paying me. I wish they would, but, you know.
We'll work on it. We'll work on it.
Donate some cheese to the festival.
Right.
You know.
So
and
they must
trying,
throw out.
Do
you think about
solicit,
how much cheese they throw out?
Yeah. Well, that's another story. You know, but we're trying to get the neighborhood involved.
Right.
It has changed so much from when we first started.
Oh,
And I just wanted to go back to Hurricane Sandy, that the year after Hurricane Sandy, We basically had a full day of nothing but Hurricane Sandy documentaries.
Oh, I remember that.
And it was so important to recognize what people went through.
Right.
And to see firsthand the stories. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were, needless to say, documentaries of the devastation. But what got me was it was really stories of hope. So it wasn't just, oh, we got slammed by the hurricane.
And we're living in a shelter. But
we got slammed by the hurricane, and now we have resurged.
We have an opportunity to rebuild and to reinvent, right?
Yeah.
All that. So have you booked some films? You must have. It's coming up in just 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah, the films are really quite amazing.
Talk about just arbitrarily, because I like to say that because if we leave any out, it has nothing to do with the quality.
Well, we've got like a movie called Born Into This about a young boxer, Sugar Boy Yonan. And
is that like a thing where you have to call yourself, the name part of your name has to be Sugar if you're going to be a boxer?
Well, it's good if your name is Sugar and you're a boxer.
Okay.
I loved Sugar Ray Leonard myself. We've got a couple of actors involved. I mean, a guy named Victor Cruz, who was in Other Woman, is featured in The Stock Room. Last year we had a movie called Shoeshine Chicken, produced by Fernando Cuestas, and he's got another movie in this one. They're beautiful shorts, really solidly done, and they're wonderful to watch. We've got little animations. We've got, you know, every piece of culture. We are an international festival, and we've got a filmmaker from Marcela Cardoza, who's a woman filmmaker from Brazil. Mm-hmm. Is screened, you know, submitted her film and got it accepted, and it's really quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm. How do you, while on the subject, since you brought it up, what is the submission process? Do you go through some sort of generic tool, or do you just take direct submissions, or do you solicit? How do you do that?
We do all three. I was working with a program director, Maurice Zapata, and he was beating the bushes for direct submissions from filmmakers. Myself, I was talking to everybody I could and always am asking, hey, that's a good movie, you want to show it? And I took submissions off of the website, and I worked through Film Freeway.
Okay.
And took submissions.
I'm not familiar with them.
And
that's
then good. I do a lot of outreach, and you know, I try to get student films, and I try to get everybody involved.
Yeah. So how many films are you showing?
I'm going to be showing probably about 20, 25. It's a two-day festival. We only have 12 hours, so,
so
we've got about four features and about 20 shorts, I guess. A couple of animations.
Did you name a couple of the features before?
The features that we're showing, Driven by Demons. We've got...
Who's director of that?
We've got Leaves of the Tree by Ante Novak. Kovic, you know, which is a really beautifully shot film done in Sicily. He's an American filmmaker. We've got, well, Victor Cruz is actually the director of The Stock Room. He's an actor, and now he's venturing into directing The Stock Room, which is 90 minutes. So we've got Jenica Carmona doing Million the Lords. And I think Driven by Demons, those are the top four long features. And then we've got, 20 or so shorts by a whole selection of filmmakers. Lee Struggs did Born Into This. Lysis Pagionis.
That's the problem with you. You're going to invite
the man,
if you're
the
inviting,
man from the city. After I talked to the filmmakers a couple of times, I know how to perfectly pronounce their names. But
And especially for those introducing them, it's nice to get it right.
Oh, I'll get it right before I have to introduce them. Because after we show the films, we do have a question and answer period, and we have a discussion panel. It's a very casual atmosphere and a very comfortable atmosphere. If you come early and you get a good couch seat or a big armchair, or you can sit in the plastic chairs, you know, depending on where you're sitting. But we've got a kind of a transgender film by Scott Bleicher. We've got a couple of really kind of we have this horror block that has some very dark films in it. And, you know, you it's kind of old school horror that you know, you can get grossed out by it. It's not just thrill packed and make you jump out of your seat.
Right. It's a little gory.
It's we got like violence. You know, but that psychological violence that they don't want you to leave the theater with, we kind of just throw it in the middle, and you'll see some nice films. I mean, you got little happy animations and things like that. So.
Terrific. So, again, it's on a Saturday and Sunday.
Saturday and Sunday, the week after President's Weekend. So it's the 17th and 18th. On the 10th, Brooklyn Waterfront Artists Coalition is having a screening of two documentaries, one from Hurricane Sandy and the other from Hurricane Katrina. And that's on the 10th, and that's going to be free. So if you're... We're also having one of the films
the
got
storm.
Accepted into the festival, Salt and Pepper and
Pepper and the Salt Sea, and then you have Stood for the Storm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a, but they kind of
so
a
that's
preview.
On the 10th, so that's kind of a prequel to the festival.
I understand. That's great. Well, I'm going to be in I'm in town the 17th.
If you're in town, please drop by.
I am. I'm in the town that weekend. It's the two weekends before that I'm out of town, so in the timing of that is pretty good, too.
We're going to put tickets on sale on Eventbrite.
Okay.
So either for the blocks or for the day or for the weekend.
What day does the tickets go on sale?
This weekend.
This weekend?
This weekend.
So tomorrow? By tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
All right. So when people are listening, tickets will already be on sale.
Tickets will be on sale.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on. I've been ignoring too many of the local film festivals a little bit. You know, it's because when one gets more involved in larger, you know, just a more film festivals, all of a sudden it's like,
well, there's so many film festivals going on. I mean, I'm looking at the New York Film Festival going, oh, I really want to see Ren, I really want to see this film,
right.
I want to participate.
Yeah, no, it's there's a,
and then the smaller films, I mean, they're all like, they're three in Jersey.
Oh, sure. But you know? You're just missing, and you're after the Hamptons too.
Yeah.
So it's a good weekend.
We've kind of claimed that the weekend either before or after President's Weekend.
Yeah.
We kind of found a nice spot. I mean, we tried it during President's Weekend. It didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's so much happening, and I love participating in these things. But I mean, the reason I know you is because you had a documentary about you at the Red Hook Film Festival.
Well, I do want to let's clarify.
there was a
short that was that somebody made, a filmmaker,
about Filmwax,
about what I was doing at the time, because I had my own film series. This was even before, or maybe while. No, I might have been doing the podcast, but it was and I was probably internet radio when I started with the Bebox people, and so. Which was a nice collective of very talented people, but I just saw this kind of being beyond just Brooklyn, even though that was where it was started from. And
no, and that's, roots, it, and that's it's why really good.
I keep circling
back. I've had lots
back.
Of films about,
yeah.
And it's very educational. I mean, I've been seeing all the films for 9 years now, and I know everything about every little documentary that was made in the last 10, 12 years in our neighborhoods.
Right.
It's
pretty remarkable.
They're wonderful stories. It's a wonderful place. And even if you're from out of town, come on down.
There is
transportation. You take the B61 bus.
Right from the
Borough Hall.
Oh, okay.
And
which
you
every
can get right
train
there.
Stops
or
at right over there.
The real trick is taking the IKEA ferry and getting out at Fairway.
Oh, because it's...
Nobody's
going to
check
your seat.
Just say you're going to go buy some furniture.
Oh, at IKEA.
Yeah.
So you're saying there's a
ferry that goes right
and
from
they,
downtown.
Do they underwrite that?
And goes right 2 blocks away from us.
Do they underwrite that? So it's free?
No, they don't underwrite us.
I don't mean that. I'm saying, do they underwrite the ferry?
Yes.
Are they paying
yes,
for
it's
it?
A free ferry.
Because, don't tell anybody.
I would never advocate a ride from IKEA, but...
No. No, but you could
it's
go...
It's a lot of fun.
We're suggesting to go to IKEA after...
Oh, of course.
You'll need your refreshments.
I mean, you know, you might need Swedish meatballs after seeing a good film.
That's true. You can go to IKEA and have great Swedish meatballs. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, there's so much, and you can get a cup of coffee at the other stores. I mean, but you could also go down and get lobster rolls. I mean, Red Hook is happening.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it always was.
And they're, you know, like during the 10th, we're looking forward to building some really strong relationships with a lot of the art events and a lot of the spaces and a lot of the restaurants. And so, you know, keep your eyes open, redhookfilmfest.com, and see what's going to happen. I'm very interested, and I read the thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay, up here now is Stephen Winter and Jack Waters. I could do an elaborate intro about the two gentlemen, but we talk about both of them at length in this conversation. And I was really delighted. We recorded this conversation in the East Village home of Jack Waters, who is a longtime figure in the East Village from the art scene. In the alternative art scene and the gay art scene. And Stephen is a very talented filmmaker who I think whose career is just starting to take off, considering how fantastic this movie is. And I'm sure it's going to get wonderful reception at MoMA, at the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown, New York City. Again, coming up from Monday the 19th through, I think, the 27th. It's a 10-day run. So again, if you're around, do check it out. So here's my conversation now with Stephen Winter and Jack Waters.
My mother always told me, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
Jason.
Keep something for 7 years.
Jason by Shirley Clarke.
You'll find Take some one. Use for it. Problem with unemployment is, as soon as you wake up, you're on the job.
Don't feel like you have to put on a show. You know, just be yourself.
Boom.
This talk like an interview.
Ooh-wee. Why do Jewish divorces cost so much? Because they're worth it. Nico, why don't you light this cigarette before you sit on my face?
Light a cigarette. You're giving the audience what they want.
What they think they want.
Come in! Everybody come on, come in!
Performance-wise, and how much love that that had for folks. And that is similar to what Jack does in this thing. Mm-hmm. And we have an excitingly thrilling, uplifting ending. And that is all. Comes out of nowhere because you go through so many circles of... you know, the seven circles of hell, we have at least three or four.
I mean, I don't know. Like the last person one wants to talk about, what is the sort of the shrewd way to cast a film or to plot, you know, how to plot it out? I'm good at marketing hard-to-market films, I think, because I'll just say, yeah, but you'll leave in tears or you'll leave having felt elevated emotionally. And
you'll
and
leave feeling
you
feelings.
Feel feelings, and that yeah. translates into feeling more alive.
Yeah.
And it's and you'll be able to say afterwards, I feel satisfied. I've been, like, fed. My
yes.
soul has been fed.
Yes.
So I don't think when you leave, you know, I won't bring up any... specific examples. There are a lot of movies you leave and you have some fun, hopefully. Mm. You maybe feel even that you got your money's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way I explain to people is that it's deeply disturbing and it's hilarious.
Hilariously disturbing, in other words. Right, Jack?
Things can be two things at the same time.
Oh, absolutely.
These are the voices of Jack Waters and Stephen Winter. And the film is called Jason and Shirley. I've seen it three times. So, you know.
Wow.
It's more my... So, Jason and Shirley, I know. Let's get this out of the way. It's, you know, you were on the show already, Stephen. So, people that listen to the show know already about the film. It's sort of a fictional, quasi-fictional account, let's say, or an imagined account of how the day went when Shirley Clarke, the filmmaker, but it's shot almost where you guys shot it, almost documentary style. So, it looks as though you're watching is a documentary making of a documentary. Of course, we know better.
Well, the way I describe it is that I am not an aging homosexual hustler from the 1960s, but I play one on screen.
That being,
yes, he does.
And so incredibly well. So Jason Holliday, was a kind of a notorious downtown character, right, in the day. And so he, for you know, loving attention, probably, not probably, loving attention, he agreed to sit for this documentary. And I think Shirley Clarke had an agenda, which was to crack him open and to get a huge performance out of him, but a different kind of performance, probably one that wasn't necessarily intentional.
Well, I think she talks about wanting to get to a truth in cinema verite, and her goal with Jason was to get him to sort of break down his masks and expose something real about the human condition. And being a black, gay, middle-aged male prostitute and would-be cabaret star, he was sort of in her position that's like the lowest of the low. And if you can get the lowest of the low to say something real, then something transcendent might happen artistically. Mm-hmm. That is how I interpret her understanding of it. But I think the other brilliant thing about Shirley Clarke is that there's lots of different ways to read her.
Yeah.
My approach to the role is that, as an artist myself, I look at really long histories of art and art making, and the idea that art and artifice come from the same roots, I think, is not coincidental, in that a lot of times, or most of the time, people are reaching for what they consider real and the truth, with big quotes around it. Mm-hmm. And I think now that we're in this age of reality-based media, it seems like it's something new, but I don't think it's new at all. So what happens with Shirley Clarke's portrait of Jason is I believe that she did have an agenda to get to the truth. And as Stephen was saying, that Jason's position in the social hierarchy, being at the very, very rock bottom low, and something that had never really been discussed in serious echelons of culture, would be something that Shirley would want to get at. But also faced with this insurmountable object of Jason as a natural performer and a natural entertainer, there is always this question of, well, is this real? Is this true? So I believe this is what Jason and Shirley starts to be at, is getting behind that notion of how do you break something down to its smallest component? I was comparing it to smashing atoms in a way. Like in science, you want to know, well, what are things made of? So you just keep breaking them and breaking them and breaking them and breaking them. And you may not know what the actual substance is or does, but you do know that at a certain point, you get to a place where you can't go any further.
Word. Yeah, well said.
She left in the original documentary, again, Portrait of Jason, she did leave in some moments where she was not egging him on, but sort of badgering him to open up, right?
She speaks throughout it.
She does, right? So she wasn't necessarily hiding this idea that she was trying to get him to, as you say, get to the truth.
No.
She was open about it, so there is that. But because a true verite, she would just let him be.
Yes.
And so it was, as we say now, scripting, you know, we call it. I had a big conversation this past weekend with somebody who was in that reality television produce on the production side about that. Like, you know, well, we don't write it down. They improvise. Mm. But now what we call scripting in a casual sense is when you tell them you're going to go over here and you're going to talk about, you're going to have a kind of a conversation, knowing full well it's going to turn into a fight. But, you know, you're going to talk about this affair that you caught your husband having. What do you think is going to happen?
As does all documentaries.
And here's some alcohol, by the way.
Yeah, you have to write.
Which they do here, too.
Yes. Jason takes a lot of alcohol.
He's offered it a lot.
Yes. He smokes a lot of cigarettes. And he is, which is probably not too dissimilar than what he might be doing normally that night.
True.
He was, after all, a professional in all senses of the word, including drinking and smoking and partying and having a good time.
Yeah.
And talking that talk.
And singing.
Shooting the shit.
And singing.
And doing impressions and told stories and spun wisdom. And that was really kind of how he plied his trade. You know, being somebody who you want to have around At a party or in a situation or in a scene. He was a houseboy to many wealthy men and women, and part of the job of being houseboy is to be charming and to reflect well upon your host. Mm-hmm. And so he knew how to do that. And I think what Shirley was doing was she did not want him to continue to try to reflect well upon her as a host. Yeah. She wanted to get something that was deeper because she, you know, and this is going from quotes of what she said about herself, she didn't want to talk about being a woman in her work. She wanted to talk about being a woman through the eyes and the personification of the black male.
Right.
And that's what she made all her films about, yeah. As black men.
Right. And she was in a relationship.
And she was in a relationship with a black man, well. Carl Lee, who is also involved in the Portrait of Jason filming and is fictionalized in our film by my very handsome brother-in-law, Orrin Farmer.
But before I want to go back to this whole thing about Shirley Clarke's strategy, because it's known that in her early cut of The Portrait of Jason, or at least in seeing the first rushes, when she heard what was going on behind the camera, she made a deliberate choice to keep that in.
Right.
So it's definitely to her credit to realize that the verite, that she was expanding this notion of verite that went beyond a kind of generic notion of what verite is as a style and going back, I guess, to the realness of it by saying, well, no, this is what's really happening. We're really doing this to this person.
Yes. That's what I was getting at. That's actually what I was getting at. That's
really to her credit.
It is to her. That's what I was trying to get
that
at.
She necessarily fully realized how people would ultimately look at her, and I think that has to do with class differences, but she had the guts and the foresight
to
keep her voice and the other voices in.
Hell yeah.
I was definitely trying. That's what I was getting at, because if she had left it out, it would have been a dishonest. It would not have been verite. It would have been fake, because she had to leave herself in, which was kind of breaking a rule of verite. Setting up this odd dichotomy because, had she left herself out, he would have been getting increasingly, let's say, closer, as you put it, to the breaking of the atom or the peeling away of the onion layers, however you want to put it. But it wasn't organic. She was pushing and pushing, and then she brought in Carl, her boyfriend, to take over because she she was getting frustrated.
Well, take over the role of talking. Like, and this is one thing I think is very specific that I try to address in Jason and Shirley. It's not that she gave up the directorial reins of her film.
No, I get it.
But she did bring in a significant different voice, which is that of another black man.
Yeah.
You know, and she's also was wise enough to understand that Jason performing in a room full of a white crew is different than Jason talking to another brother.
Sure.
And so the reason that Carl is involved is because Carl had to be involved in order to get that level of breakdown performance from Jason. Shirley knew that Jason wouldn't give that to her. It would take family to do that.
Which, again, you have to realize this is not specific to Portrait of Jason as much as it receives its, I guess, climax or apotheosis in Portrait of Jason, because Carl Lee had worked with Shirley on two of her previous films, and I think for a lot of the same reasons.
Exactly.
Authenticity.
Well, right. And you said she was already making films about black men.
All of her films centered around black people. And specifically black men.
Right.
But one of the things, and you know, I was only half joking when I talk about this being disturbing and hilarious, because all of these dramatis persona are really what make Jason and Shirley. And what happens in Stevens, Jason and Shirley is that we go one up on Shirley Clarke in that we're not allowing these voices behind the camera, but we're actually bringing these figures to the screen, including Shirley.
Indeed. Yeah. That was the beginning of how we were framing our fiction, is to, like, Shirley let go of a certain amount of boundary when she changed her method of cinema verite. We wanted to change the boundary of what Portrait of Jason describes of this historical event of Jason Holliday being filmed by bringing in not only a fictional crew, which could also represent different aspects of society, but the people that he tells stories about, we actually visualize them. He dreams them up. He brings them in a Christmas Carol style, and we get to meet the folks that he's talking about and live in his mind, and to quote the film, live in his world. It is the most exciting part of the whole thing is that we're not doing a remake and we're not doing a 2.0. We are putting ourselves in Jason Holliday's head and heart. Mm. And that's what the film is. And that's why it is harrowing and hysterical all at the same time. Yeah. Because why wouldn't it be? This is the best. This is the first Snap Queen on record.
Right.
You know, she's the one. Yep.
And this is where you get at this whole idea of like the meta writing that you started to talk about, because when Steven realized that he wanted to bring these characters to life, he literally created this structure, which is basically the stories that Jason Holliday tells, but then elaborating them and embellishing them, I guess, in what French call the mise-en-scène.
That's what they call it.
Right? And so then you have this whole, like, structure that is not necessarily literary in that kind of scripted, inscripted sense, mm-hmm. but is very much constructed and very much deliberately constructed in the way that it's formulated in this picture.
Yeah, yeah. And in so doing, we could make something that no one had ever seen before, mm-hmm. you know, because it wasn't about recreating anything. It was about reimagining.
No. Yeah. I appreciate the also that if you watch the films back to back, I would argue Jack is not really doing an impression. You're not trying to do, at least it doesn't come off like you're trying to do an impression. You're doing an interpretation of this guy.
Exactly.
But it's a performance of yours. And yet, and probably the same goes for Sarah Schulman, who plays Shirley Clark. She didn't really look that much like her. I mean, there's maybe some similarities possibly, but the point being is the filming itself is made to look like you're actually shooting something real that day. So there's another dichotomy in a way. You know, it's kind of interesting. Somebody who had never read up on it, they would probably think they're watching, like I said at the beginning, a documentary.
My brother, who writes for television in L.A. And is a very smart gentleman, told me after he saw it, even though he is my brother, and even though he knows how these things happen, he felt like he was watching something that had been dug up from a basement for 30 years,
like
an artifact, something a little illicit. He was blown away by how you go from feeling like you're a fly on the wall to feeling like you're in the room physically to feeling like you are in their heads.
Yeah, it's and that is always oh shoot. Anyway, you know, it's
atom breaking.
But we know, Stephen. Last time you did this, that it's shot on analog.
Right. Super VHS.
Super VHS.
90% of the film is shot on Super VHS.
And you don't know what you're going to get. And so that adds to that when you process or when you finish and you're looking at it.
But there is this aspect to this being what I believe and agree with Stephen, that this is something that has never been seen before. Because there is absolutely a mimetic aspect to both my approach and Sarah's approach to these two characters, and both in our different ways. I looked at Jason Holliday. I looked at his manner of speech. I looked at his posture. I looked at his appearance and definitely made those attempts at recreating those, but at the same time brought to Jason aspects of his character that I projected on him as a fictitious character. And then also an aspect of the character that Steven again brought to it, which is Jason as an uncooperative and angry person.
Exactly.
Which you don't see in Shirley Clark's film.
Right.
And so bringing these aspects of emotion, of course, like any other actor, are things that I brought from my own personal experience.
Sure.
From the character aspects that Steven gave to the character, and then from the Jason Holliday that we saw, add to this amalgamation of like reality, unreality, which is what also gives it that like super trippy aspect of experience.
It is trippy. I started when I saw it at Jonathan's apartment.
Yes.
The first time.
You saw rough cuts.
I saw yeah. Well, the whole thing is a rough cut.
A coarse cut.
A coarse cut. I really felt like I was being mindfucked.
Yeah, it's like being on acid. I think this is like
disturbing,
what a lot of people go through with these ideas of like self, not self. I like, who am I? What aspect of me is a performance constructed for other people? And what aspect of me is actually me? And why and who am I doing this for?
So I would
crazy.
It is.
You know, when kids watch it, and kids are a lot more like the kids who are really up to date on what's going on with identity issues. They understand racial politics, sexuality, gender. They don't start their conversations about it with the race or the sex or the sexuality orientation. They talk about it as their personal identities. Uh-huh. And what happens in terms of what is your mask, your human being, what is your human aspect when you take your mask off? Is there just another mask? Mm-hmm. The existential crisis that's at the center of this whole situation is what they felt the most uplifted by because it addressed it. And that has been very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Very and the Super VHS certainly contributes to this whole effect.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was part of why I wanted to use it, because I felt it immediately puts people upright in their seats and looking attentively, because it's so odd. Either it's something familiar to you because you were in the VHS era, or you're too young for it, but you know what it feels like to feel like you're watching something that's perhaps dangerous. There's something dangerous about VHS right now, especially because it feels alive. Mm. And that's why I really wanted to shoot with it, because I felt that this particular story would come alive more when the medium it was actually, the clay it was being made from, was also alive. Mm-hmm. It could have a mind of its own. And I swear to gosh, if you look at the footage, it changes with the mood of the scene. It gets redder when you're redder as the character. It gets sky blue when it gets sensual when it's time to be sensual. It goes crazy when people are really angry. It really sucked in all of the energy of the drama. It did.
So again, it has that hallucinatory element to it, but at the same time, being video, and especially old-timey video, it is a documentary medium. Mm-hmm. So people are automatically compelled to think that they're seeing something real, which they are.
Yeah. Yeah. These are cameras that were used by the TV news in the 80s.
Right.
They were meant to be used outdoors in sunny conditions, which is why we use them indoors in low light. And yeah, they're about as they were crew members who were not as old as our cameras.
Wow.
Oh, sure.
And both cameras died after we finished shooting.
Is that right?
They're in camera heaven now.
How do you guys know each other originally?
Well, I moved to New York in 93, and
from
Chicago.
Okay.
And slowly started getting myself involved in a lot of different scenes, including the Lower East Side art scene, which intersects with a queer scene, which intersects with a lot of other things. And mm-hmm. Jack Waters was
at
already a prominent central figure in that world. Mm-hmm. So I don't recall our origin story, but I do recall, like, oh yeah, there's Jack Waters.
Right. There's not an origin story, but we were very much in the same circle. I was one of the original filmmakers in Mix Festival, which at the time is the New York Lesbian and Gay Experimental Film Festival. And when Steven came into that circle, it was an event. And so, you know, we knew Steven, we knew what he was doing. We were not necessarily hanging tight, mm-hmm. but it was definitely a figure that had come into the sphere.
Yeah, it's like Jack was one of the people that had moved to New York to meet. Mm-hmm. You know, a person who lived and breathed and worked their art, and that's who they were, and that's why they're here. And he's black and very, very handsome. You know, and, you know, it's funny. We have a promotional postcard of Jack as Jason with the glasses and everything. Right. And I do want to really emphasize that when you watch Jason and Shirley, you're not watching Jack Waters. You're watching Jack Waters play this part.
Yeah, for sure.
And people look at the postcard who have just met them, and then they look at me and they go, "Is this you?" And at first I'm like, well, Jack is much more handsome than me. So, like, no, it's not me. But two, I like, well, does all black people look alike? What are you trying to say? But then I understand that actually what Jack is doing, he is channeling a piece of my energy that I wanted. That's the directing actor relationship. So I take it as a great compliment. It's like, yes, that is me.
Very much so. I mean, this is also something that I experienced when looking at the character. Mm-hmm. And realizing in cinema how this channeling of Steven's Jason is being performed and realized in my body. It's very strange and interesting and amazing, like ultimate collaboration. I mean, this is the kind of collaboration that people strive all their lives for.
Yeah.
It's
my crowning achievement to date. Oh, and well, I doubt it will.
We're still young puppy,
but this will always be a central gem in my crown.
I imagine so, because it's
this
really,
moment with Jack Waters. It's ridiculous how good he is. I mean, it just got to see it for him.
Well, I think the our friends at MoMA are in agreement with you.
Indeed, as well they should be.
These are, it's unprecedented, like a 10-day run at MoMA.
Starting, it's from October 19th to the 27th.
Mm-hmm.
The 19th is already sold out, but either Jack or Jason or Sarah or all three of us will be at every screening.
Really?
Either speaking or just hanging out. And just
as in all three or various?
There will be numerous screenings where we will all three be present, okay, for sure.
That's great.
Yeah. And the Schomburg is going to host the one on the 23rd. The Schomburg is the African American Museum of Culture. And we're looking to put together a couple other panels for later on that week. It's just going to be fun.
We couldn't not do this. I have to say again that it sounds almost cliche, but it's really true that this is the type of movie that exists off the screen. When, like, for the moment we approached it as an experience that would reverberate from us to the people behind the camera, which oftentimes were in front of the camera, and to the people that we imagined watching it, even as it goes into this kind of exhibition. So us being in the theater is a part of the experience for sure. We wouldn't miss it for the world.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was at the BAM Cinema Fest screening.
Yeah.
Or Q&A, I should say. And it was the probably one of the most enthusiastic crowds. I mean, just sort of so gratified and
Jack and Sarah and I and the rest of the company created sort of a cinematic seance. We kind of conjured up a lot of different elements to get the movie to the place where it got to. And part of the payoff is that is A, the vermicillitude of what happens is incredible. But B, it brings you, the viewer, into its brand of magic and the particularity of when Jack looks into the camera. It's like he is staring into your soul.
Right.
And I've only actually seen this done one other time, and I actually rewatched this movie recently to make sure it was what I thought, and it was Zoot Suit from 1981 with Edward James Olmos. It's a musical.
Yeah, it was a play.
It was a play.
It was at the public theater.
And he plays like the Joel Grey master of ceremonies and such. And the first thing he does is he comes out of the curtain and he stares into the camera. Edward James Olmos, and he bores a hole into you. It's like the greatest special effect. Lucas couldn't have done better. Jack does a similar thing. It's in that same world. I'm now comparing him to Edward James Olmos, and it's an apt comparison.
And one of the greatest, I'd say, last moments of a film I've seen in a long time, too.
Thank you very much. We worked very hard on that ending.
It's pitch perfect. And nobody will expect it.
Yes, it has an uplifting / gotcha ending.
Yeah, it sure does. Again, I don't know if we've done it justice. You really can't. And let me just say to those listening, if you haven't seen the source material, let's call it, which is A Portrait of Jason, directed by Shirley.
Shirley Clark.
I know. Don't go see it. I would say actually see this first and then see it but if you've already seen it, good.
Yeah.
It's not like it will change the experience, but I would almost say see this first and then go back and see the other thing. Because then you can kind of compare and contrast and do all those things, but don't go into it trying to compare and contrast if you don't have to. Look at it as its own.
You don't need
on
to.
On its own merits, on its own basis, it's on its own.
Yeah, we made really, the film,
yeah,
so you didn't. It's its own thing.
Sure, absolutely. We'll be clear about that. So,
yeah.
And it'll be at MoMA. So if you're in the New York City area, come down. Or even if you're not, but it's right as all the tourists are starting to come into town too. So maybe we'll fool some innocent Midwesterners.
That would be delightful.
That's where you're from. But to come and accident. Well, oh, there's a movie at MoMA. We should go see that. Well, you know, we're in New York, we should do that. And then they'll come out, like, changed forever. They'll never go back to, you know, Green Bay or wherever
they're
from.
It's my dream to take this film deep into the heartland.
Oh, my goodness.
I think, because one thing that it's about when you strip away the aspects of race and class, and it's about power. And everybody can really relate to this. And it's also about having to account for oneself. And that's another thing I think universally people can relate to. It's a very American story, and I'm really we have some distributors are circling us, and we have a few plans that we're trying to put into action. But so we're very excited about a fabulous New York MoMA run that can then demonstrate how well this is going to play in Peoria.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think this is the only thing that makes it very American is that it is an anomaly. And
yes, yes.
Anomalies are strange in that I think there is a kind of an attraction revulsion around it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, you know, like America, it's this idea of this pioneering spirit of just like pushing through to this next level. And that's what we do here.
Word. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's one of the great pleasures of making this film of Jack and Sarah is that not only have they been, you know, we're talking about like a friendship that goes back like 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And they're both geniuses. And they're both sweethearts. And being able to sit down in a room with them and devise and then execute this amazing result was just an absolute pleasure. Because when you work with brilliant people, things are simpler. And that is another big lesson I've learned. And if you have two geniuses, work with them.
Right. And to work with Sarah on this gut level was also something I'd known Sarah for years. Sarah is one of the founders of the Mix Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd always known Sarah as someone who was presenting my cinematic work. And Sarah's also an amazing writer. And I had a period where I was publishing a lot in film journals and so forth. And so Sarah was a mentor for me in a big way, like all of my writing. But I never worked on a performance level with Sarah. So it was really...
Changed the dynamic of your relationship, huh?
Yes and no. Oh. I would say that the dynamic of our relationship informed this work to a high degree. I don't think it changed.
I
don't think it changed the dynamic. I think the dynamic...
Changed the movie.
Made it made us able to do this. In other words, to
right.
play these characters
yeah.
that are on
nice
oppositional
little,
sides of the power of the power pole.
Right.
But at the same time, being very close friends personally. So this idea of like being in this knockdown, slug out, like psychological celebrity death match with my best friend.
Yeah.
Also adds that level of anomaly, I think, because I think in any deep relationship, even if it's one that's guided by great animosity, the affection and the desire
sure.
and the love
and the
for
trust.
Each other and the trust.
Because you can go there.
Yeah.
And you know you're being taken care of when you're going out.
Oh, yeah.
When you're letting go.
Yeah, yeah. And Sarah locked it down
with the Shirley.
It was a character also I think that she was born to play. And she said, I know this character. I am this character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it was. Looking at Sarah and looking at Shirley had this meta feeling to it. And then with Steven being on the set, which in a lot of ways I think was the amalgamation of both.
Kind
of. becomes like this mm-hmm. whole other atmosphere of surreality.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I think it's a good place to leave it, but I can't wait to hear all about how it goes at MoMA.
Oh, so. I can't wait to tell you.
Yeah.
Cannot wait to tell
it's
you.
It's a remarkable opportunity, and, you know, I'm sure it'll go great. So,
Jason and Shirley, now at MoMA, and later the world.
Okay, guys, Michael Schultz, if you're over the age of 30 or 40, I'm sure you've seen Michael Schultz films. I mean, first of all, this is the guy that he's been making films for decades now. He started as a very young man. I guess his breakout film in 1975 was Coolie High, which really connected with many audiences because here it was about a group of young guys who were coming out of high school and living in Chicago. And just this was like, you know, their life. It was very, very, it was fun and carefree. And it, and the characters just happened to be young black men. So it was a way coming out of a period of black exploitation to introduce this concept of, hey, you know, these are black people in this country too. And they don't live their lives purely by the black experience. So, the movie really did, you know, connect with audiences, both black and non-black. And so he went on, as a result of this great success of Coolie High, to make Car Wash in 1976, Grease Lightning in 77, Which Way Is Up also in 77. All those three films featured Richard Pryor. So there was a relationship there which went on, which was one of the focuses that the Museum of the Moving Image recently had, their relationship. They did three different programs with Michael. And I'm telling you this sort of in past tense because it's already over, but it's the circumstances. And they did a 40th anniversary screening of Coolie High. After that period, he went on to bigger budget films and made Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, with, you know, which featured, of course, Beatles music. And went on to make a movie, The Last Dragon, Crush Groove. Oh, what else did he do? You know, let's see. Endless television. I mean, the guy has been doing so much TV over the last couple of decades. I can't even begin to tell you. So he's just a, one of these reliable, you know, for hire TV guys. But he's part of an important period of movie making. And I couldn't believe this guy is in his mid-70s. He looks like somebody probably about 20 years younger. So it was a delight. As you'll hear in a few minutes, this is a great, great guy and a great filmmaker with a lot of great stories, which we barely were able to skim the surface of. But here it is, my conversation with the filmmaker, Michael Schultz. Thank you. I'll make this available to you. We'll figure out. Just make sure it happens. I'm not worried. I'll get it to Tomoko or to whomever. And,
Perfect.
So this podcast is basically anyone who's like a stakeholder in the world of cinema, but independent film or art film, classic films, would be great, you know, on my show. So I kind of talk to the whole spectrum of people.
Right.
But mostly filmmakers. They're probably the largest.
Great. I'm going to have to tune in.
Oh, I hope
subscribe.
So.
Subscribe.
I would be very, very honored. And in fact, I was the anecdote I was going to tell you was that I just had it on Roger Corman just the other day, which was because he was over at Film Anthology for a couple of appearances.
Right.
And I had already arranged it sort of with the office, his office in L.A., but I went to I had trouble getting through one day to his hotel, so the next day when he told me to call back, I went to the hotel first, and I just thought, if I'm in the lobby, he's not gonna, he's not gonna make it past me without my knowing.
Right.
So he just happened to be in the cafe when I got there, and you know, so I was, now do I ambush him or how does this all work out? But he was so nice, terrific guy. But AIP on the subject. Oh, and the thing is that this I wasn't really prepared to go like that. He said, "Let's do it now."
Right.
I said, "Oh, I thought we were going to do it like in an hour or two. You're going to make the Zoom ran out of batteries."
Ah.
Fortunately, we're right next to an outlet, but there is that moment where you're like, "How? What an unprofessional!" Only think better than to then publicize it on my next thing with you.
Exactly.
So I plugged it in anyway. Coolie High, was it Coolie High or was it what?
Coolie High was AIP.
Was AIP?
Yeah.
Was he involved in that?
No.
Was he already?
He
gone
had
by
already.
That?
Yeah.
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 He,
right.
It was Nicholson and Sam Arkoff.
Arkoff. Right.
Yeah.
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 Right. How are they to work with?
Arkoff was great. Arkoff was the one who kind of had an intuition that this would be a good project to do because it was so different from Hell Up in Harlem and Sheba Baby and you know,
post blaxploitation in other words, right?
Yeah, or Beach Blanket Bingo, all the kind of stuff they were doing,
right. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And but the rest of the company AIP had no clue, and were actually shocked when they saw the film. They said, well, where's the TNA? How do we sell this? You know, it's amazing. But Arkoff was a champion of the project from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Did they do something ultimately back then? Because I don't know, I was too young, but did they have tried to market it in such a way that made you in any way?
Not really. I mean, what they did was they put out a poster that looked like a group of gangbangers, you know, in front of a high school, and kind of appealed to, made it seem like it was tougher than it really was, you know?
Understood. Yeah. So there'd be a little bit of a, it's not really, well, it's a little, of course it's exploitative, but it's also trying to create a little bit of a, it's an exaggeration, obviously.
Yeah,
exactly. Because it's a comedy. And it came out in 1975.
Right.
Just to take a little baby step back, as they often have to do because they hit the ground running. You are here at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, New York, for a retrospective of your collaborations with Richard Pryor. Is that the right way to put it?
That's the right way to put it today. And last week it was all about Cooley High, and next week it's all about the music in my films. And
right. Oh, okay. And so it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, for 4 weeks.
Oh, fantastic. So,
yeah,
so it's
great.
Four different themes?
Four different themes.
Oh, okay. Very good. All right. I knew that. And, of course, well, I like this idea, the collaboration idea, too.
Right.
And Cooley High just happened to also have its 40th anniversary this
exactly.
year.
Exactly.
So that was a good enough to launch or to kind of inspire
the series.
A larger retrospective of your work.
Right.
And you are a New Yorker?
I am not a New Yorker. I'm a Midwesterner. I was born in Milwaukee.
Right.
But I lived in New York for 10, 11 years trying to make my way into film via theater. So I became a theater director first.
Right. And you're probably best known for Lorraine
Hansberry's To Be Young, Gifted, and Black was actually the very first film that I ever did based on the off-Broadway play.
Right. Raisin in the Sun, I guess I was thinking.
Raisin in the Sun was Lloyd Richards.
Lloyd Richards,
another great black director.
But no, but I'm talking about like in the doing a version of the play.
Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, my launch as a director in theater was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Was I directed the first play of the Negro Ensemble Company in 68 or 69, I don't remember, called The Song of the Lusitanian Bogey, by Peter Weiss, and it won me an Obie Award for Best Director that year.
Uh-huh.
So
the wonder kind, the kid, the new kid.
Yeah,
yeah.
On the block.
Yeah. did you have any inkling even? I mean, it sounds like the theater was where you were at. I mean, did you even at that point think about the film as an option?
Oh, absolutely.
You were.
Okay. I wanted to direct film.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a kid from Milwaukee, no connection to the business, the industry, you know, and couldn't afford to go to film school. And there were only three at the time, USC, UCLA, and NYU. And somebody said, well, why don't you go to theater? Go to theater school. Got a great one in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to get out of Milwaukee,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But I wound up at that theater school at Marquette. Mm-hmm. It was the best training that I ever could have gotten.
Yeah.
Because by the time I got to New York, I could dance, I could sing, I could act, I could build sets, I could design lights. So it took me about 3 days to get a job in theater. And once you're in the mix, you know, things happen.
Right. And if you're open to it and if you're social, you're going to meet people and an opportunity will come along.
And it's all about getting people to know what you can do and trust that you do it better than anybody else, you know?
So how did you make that transition then if you didn't go to film school, right?
I read every book that I could read about how to make a movie and all the great filmmakers. My film school was actually my sophomore year in Madison, Wisconsin at University of Wisconsin. I was studying to be an astronaut and realized that that was like not in the cards for me. And so I spent most of my time in the movie theaters watching Fellini, Bergman, Antonioni, Lelouch, you know, all these great filmmakers telling stories that were not Hollywood type stories. And I'm sitting back in the theater saying, you know, we have so many stories that have not been told from our culture that would help build bridges of understanding. And I'd love to be able to do that. But that it was the furthest thing away from what I thought was possible. I was just interested. And my way to get there was through theater. And I had a theory as a sophomore in college. Well, if I make a reputation in the theater as a director, somebody will offer me a movie. And after I directed my first Broadway play, which I cast a young actor named Al Pacino, called Does the Tiger Wear a Necktie?
What year was that?
That was 1969.
Okay.
Maybe 70.
Was that before or after he did An Indian Takes the Bronx?
Was it? It was after Indian.
Okay.
So Al was a known quantity as far as, you know, this incredible young actor off-Broadway.
Right.
But this was like his Broadway debut.
Oh, wow. Okay. You know, it's interesting. I also had on, and I promise you I have on emerging filmmakers as often as I'll maybe have established filmmakers, but I had on Jerry Schatzberg as well.
Ah.
And so I was what an unbelievable story. You know, we just kind of, you could go an hour or two just, and you don't get beyond the 60s,
right,
you know, which is incredible. Right. We're barely into the 70s. But yeah, it's an incredible, incredible period, it sounds like.
Oh, it was. The 60s in theater was electric, you know, because it was more the theater. There was all the musicals and all that stuff, but the theater was about things that people were dealing with every day.
Yeah.
And social issues, and, you know, it was very dynamic, very electric.
Right. And then not long after that, I guess Papp made his place downtown. Joe Papp, or maybe around
that was happening.
Yeah,
was almost the Mama. You know, Papp. It was all happening.
Interestingly, you mentioned the art films and being, you know, when you were a student over in Madison, and how huge a an influence maybe those were on your
incredible
and maybe contributed to your artistic impulses. Years later, you would make Which Way Is Up, which was based on a film. And there was a script, anyway, by Lena Wertmüller, right?
Right.
Is that true?
Right.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of a fascinating thing. And now, in some level, it makes sense, maybe, even though it might have had a completely different, you know, a sort of explanation behind it. I don't know, but...
a different way of getting there. As a matter of fact, after we finished Cooley High, the producer, Steve Krantz, came up to me and he said, you know, we should make another movie. And I said, sure, fine, great.
Yeah.
Like what? You know, and he said, well, you know, are there any black talent around that we should be thinking about? And I said, well, yeah, like Richard Pryor, for example. And he said, well, who's that?
Yeah.
And I said, Richard Pryor is probably the funniest comedian, the smartest comedian on the planet at this point in time. And I'd love to do something with that, but there's no platform for all this creative black artists. And he said, okay, well, let me think about that. So he goes away. He comes back a week or two later and says, have you ever seen The Seduction of Mimi? I said, no, I don't go to pornos, you know? He said, no. No, it's not a porno. It's an Italian film that's about politics and ambition and, you know, giving up your soul, you know, to make it. And I said, okay, well, let me see it. So I watched the movie. Great movie, by the way. Lena Wertmüller is one of my favorite female directors, period. And I said, oh, yeah, Richard could play this in a heartbeat. And he said, okay, well, great. I'll get the rights to do an American version of it. Mm-hmm. And you get Richard, and we'll make the movie, you know? So that's how Which Way Is Up came to be in the beginning.
Oh, I see. Okay. But you had already had collaborations with him. Right, right. I mean, maybe.
We had been talking.
Okay, but he was in Car Wash though, but which is
right. he was in car, well,
but not the main.
This conversation happened before I got Car Wash.
Okay,
so when Cooley High came out in the theaters, Universal called me up and said, "We got a project we think you'd be interested in."
So that was more of a. In other words, you developed Which Way Is Up. It sounds
started.
Like.
Yeah, we were
and,
starting.
And this one
the
was sort of a Car Wash was more of a for a hire.
Absolutely.
Situation based on the reception of Cooley High,
of Cooley High.
I guess was pretty good.
Reception of Cooley High was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a big success, and it made all the people of finance and happy. And
absolutely.
That. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
What was the reaction? Were African Americans looking for also at this particular moment in time for something that reflected more their story?
Well, absolutely.
Which was absent from cinema entirely.
Yeah. There was a real backlash against the blaxploitation, the typical, you know, get whitey movies and my gun is bigger than your gun, you know. Because that was all that was being put out there. Mm-hmm. And so when Cooley High hit the scene, I mean, it was about real kids in a real situation. It had heart, it had love, it had humor, and it wasn't a black movie. It wasn't about black in a white world. You know, it was just about kids who happened to be black.
Right. Yeah. They happened to be black.
Yeah.
Right. And it starred, you know, Glenn Russell, Terman. Glenn Terman, who... before Aretha Franklin, maybe, and maybe, and Lauren, he was married to her a little later on.
Yeah,
Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, of course, Garrett Morris, who probably just around the time got Saturday Night Live, and a cameo, although I don't remember seeing it, by a very, very young Robert Townsend, right?
Exactly.
These things, by the way, are not so hard to find. I did a little research, but I thought that's pretty amazing because that's a year, at least a decade before he became a filmmaker. So.
Exactly. Well, he was a talented young kid who had two lines,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
And
it was shot in Detroit?
No, it was shot in
where was it
in
shot?
Chicago,
of course. Cooley
Cabrini
High, the real
Green.
Cool. Yeah, and there was it was based on the real school.
Yeah.
So, right, I'm sorry, of course.
One of the toughest ghettos in the country.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Cooley High is gone, right?
Cabrini Green is gone, too. Yeah.
And there's a documentary about that one, which is pretty amazing. And then Car Wash you did, and then also, of course, Richard Pryor was in that. And
right.
that began your... several collaborations with him. Four films maybe you've done with him?
Yes. Yeah. Four films, Car Wash. Richard did that. He did a one-day part for me as a favor. You
really?
Know? Yeah. and then we were working on Which Way Is Up during that period. And Which Way Is Up was designed by me to be his first leading man role. Based on a lot of the characters that he had created in his records, you know, or the kind of comedy that he was doing on his albums. And so he announces that he's going to do this movie for Warner Brothers called Grease Lightning about a race car driver, a black race car driver, before he does Cooley High. And I said, what is wrong with you, man? you don't have to be Burt Reynolds, black Burt Reynolds, you know, it's
right.
Like,
well, was that kind of what he had in mind?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, it was an action kind of hero part.
Right.
And, so it appealed to him on a lot of levels, social, political, cultural. And,
did he want to reach all, was his like thing to really reach all audiences as broadly as possible back then? Do you think?
You know, I don't know. I think Richard wanted to make movies, you know? He wanted to... I don't think he had an idea that particular picture would reach all audiences, you know? But the character appealed to him, the story appealed to him, and he was more interested in doing things that felt right to mm-hmm. him, mm-hmm. you know.
And so he helped maneuver you into the directorial
seat? No, there, actually, they hired Melvin Van Peebles to direct that movie, and Melvin actually was doing a great job, but had creative differences with the producer, Hannah Weinstein, and they eventually fired him maybe midway in the picture or a third into the picture.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, and wow. So they fire Melvin, and Richard calls me up and says, can you come and take over this movie? Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, man. I had been on the set down in Georgia visiting with him while he was shooting, and we were working on the script of Which Way Is Up, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Moving that forward because that was going to be the next movie. And so I wind up saying, okay, well, I didn't want him to be in a failed picture before mine hit the screens, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said, sure, yeah, absolutely, I'll do it. And Melvin was great about passing the baton.
He was.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you...
The crew, you know, wanted to leave.
Right. They were loyal to him.
Yeah, after, because they felt he was getting the shaft, which he was, by mm-hmm. the way. Mm-hmm. He talked to them, sat them down, talked to them, and said, no, you know, I want you to stay, finish the picture. It's important, you know. Work with this guy,
right?
You know, I didn't know Melvin. I knew of Melvin, and he didn't know me. So it was just a very gracious passing of the baton.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And after that, that's kind of like put you on the map. This very brief period of time. It seems like there may be 3 or 4 or 5 years at the most between Coolie High and Which Way Is Up. Those four maybe films in a row. Coolie High, 75, Car Wash, Grease Lightning, Which Way Is Up.
Right.
And then after that, Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
Which was your conscious way maybe of trying something different and...
Oh, absolutely.
And doing something bigger budget and...
Hollywood has a tendency to put everybody in a box.
Right.
No matter who you are. So with the success of Coolie High, I became like the guy who could do music and comedy, you know.
Right. And Car Wash only probably cemented that.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Right.
And so I was interested in doing anything that would prove that I could do whatever genre, you know. Mm-hmm. Sgt. Pepper's came up. It was big. It was Beatles. I could do anything visually that I wanted to do with it. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a director's field day. So I decided, you know, yeah, I'll do this. Actually, Stigwood wanted me to do Grease.
Right.
They offered me Grease, but I was still cutting.
Oh my God.
Which Way Is Up.
Now that has to be something that you brings a little bile. Cause that made, how much more time do you have, by the way?
About 2 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you then. But first of all, people should know you direct a lot of TV, big television stuff now. And so you're still very much working and you seem extremely youthful and fit and, that's great. So,
you know, I look around and say, I get paid for having fun, you know?
Yeah.
For doing stuff I love. And when I stop loving it and stop having fun, I'll stop doing it and do something else, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Maybe we'll pick this up sometime down the...
We could. I'll be here for another 2 sessions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So maybe we could try to squeeze in one more because I kind of wanted to ask you about George Burns.
Okay.
It can wait. Maybe we do.
Be glad to do that. But
Yeah. thanks, everybody, for listening to that. I was going to mention a couple of other films that I saw at the Hamptons International Film Festival, which was this past Columbus Day weekend. And I saw this new film by Josh Mond, who is part of the Borderline group of guys. You know, Sean Durkin is in that group, and Antonio Campos, who has been on the show. And, you know, they made Marcy May Marlene. They made Martha, Marcy May Marlene, and a bunch of other, you know, films, including Simon Killer. And they have a new film. Again, it's directed by Josh Mond, and it stars Christopher Abbott, who is, you know, used to be on Girls. And the name of this film is James White. And I had the pleasure of talking to Christopher Abbott, just hanging out and having a nice chat with him. And the plan is, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be sitting with Josh and Christopher and talking about this new film and talking about the larger works of Borderline Films and much more. So stay tuned for that coming up soon. I saw this movie called Embrace of the Serpent, which was stunning, directed by Ciro Guerra. I apologize if I mispronounced the name. I saw a great, great entertaining documentary called Chuck Norris versus Communism, directed by Ilinka Calugaranu. It's a Romanian name, and I apologize for butchering it, but what a spectacular film. I saw a documentary called Newman, directed by John Fox, a first-time documentary by this filmmaker, and again, the Michael Moore film. So I had a really good time, and I hope that this is the beginning of many years of attending this festival, because it's really a lot of fun. The weather was really agreeable this weekend, and I had a terrific time. So thank you, everybody, at that festival. And I don't know if I properly thanked everybody over at the Woodstock Film Festival the weekend before, but I had a great time there as well. Thank you. But I want to thank everybody for that, too. Oh, I also do want to thank my host families publicly, because I stayed in the most luxurious, comfortable homes in both of these festivals. So for the Woodstock Film Festival, I stayed nearby in the town of Rhinebeck with the Silver family. So Nathan Silver, who is, of course, the filmmaker behind, you know, From Stinking Heaven and Uncertain Terms, Soft in the Head, Exit Elena. He's been on the show at least as many times, three times at least. His mother, who came with Nathan and his first appearance on Film Wax Radio, Cindy Silver, and her husband Harvey, were so amazingly hospitable and put me up and my son in Rhinebeck in their beautiful house. And so thank you to the Silver family. Thank you also to Nathan for helping make that happen. I'm so excited that we got to spend the weekend there. We had such a nice visit. And my father, thank you to him for lending me his car for the weekend so I could zip around between Kingston and Woodstock and Rhinebeck. And then last weekend, this past weekend at the Woodstock Film Festival, some of my oldest family friends on the planet, the Spitzer family, Philip and Mary, they have this exquisite property in East Hampton, up on a beautiful little out of the way spot, beautiful house, and just the most comfortable and luxurious sort of accommodations I could imagine. And thank you to those guys for being so amazing to me. And I had a wonderful evening or two in that house on a very comfortable bed, and I got some nice rest. And I didn't want to get out of the bed, I have to be honest with you. I remember the second evening I had to, I couldn't barely, after sleeping so well, I could barely get myself out of the bed to, you know, continue with the festival. So, which I had a great time. So thanks to everybody there for that. And now we're going into a little quieter time. The New York Film Festival is over as well, but coming up, I'm going to go to the Margaret Mead Documentary Film Festival, and then I'm going to go to the Doc NYC Documentary Film Festival, both happening in the next couple of weeks here in New York City, which will round out the year. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and don't forget, go to iTunes and give a star rating to me. If you're listening to this and you haven't done so yet, I'm not sure what's holding you up, but go to iTunes. It just takes a minute. Search in the search area on the store for Film Wax. And then when the search results come up, you just select the Film Wax radio button, you know, and then you'll be on our page and you can give us a star rating and even leave a review if you so wish. If you're feeling particularly ambitious, please do that. And, you know, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And, of course, we have a website. It's called filmwaxradio.com, shockingly enough. So please do be in touch. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening to this episode number 317. And we'll be back in a few days with a team behind this film called, oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. There's a documentary called Made in Japan. I saw it in Nashville at the Nashville Film Festival. In fact, I was on the jury, and we awarded it a prize. And it's a fantastic story these guys have. We'll be And of course, I heaven forbid I should forget, we're going to go to the Red Hook Film Festival this weekend too, before Margaret Mead, before Doc NYC. So, all right, everybody. But on the next show, again, is the director and subject of a wonderful new documentary called Made in Japan, a film I saw when I was in Nashville at the Nashville Film Festival. And we're also going to have on the next episode, we're going to have Justin Shine, another documentary filmmaker who made a movie called Left on Purpose. And the cinematographer, DP, whatever you want to call him, Tim Orr, who has worked on all of David Gordon Green's films, I believe, as well as a bunch of other films. So all that on the next episode of Film Wax Radio. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.